This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Ayatollah Khamenei says the United States intensified its Iranophobia and Shiaphobia campaign only after Tehran frustrated all of its criminal schemes in other countries. Hamas says the Palestinians' anti-Israel operation are a neutral response to the regime's occupation and crimes, calling for more armed struggle. Also ahead, Russia warns the United States that it is risking direct engagement in the war by supplying Ukraine with long-range weapons. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says one of the reasons behind the enmity of Erdogan powers towards Iran is that it encourages other nations to stand up against bullying tactics. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the United States is at the helm of a system of global arrogance. He said neutralizing America's criminal plots in different countries, such as the defeat of Daesh, led to widespread Iranophobia and Shiaphobia campaigns, as well as accusations that Iran is interfering in other countries' affairs. The leader emphasized that Iran does not interfere in other countries' internal affairs, noting that they make such accusations because they have failed in preventing the progress of the Islamic establishment. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said arrogant powers mean to draw unrealistic lines in the Islamic world. The leader added that the U.S. policy is to instigate conflicts between Shias and Sunnis, Arabs and non-Arabs, or even provoke infighting within Shia and Sunni communities. Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing the participants at the 7th Congress of the Ahlul Bayt World Assembly in Tehran. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has praised anti-Israeli operations in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Hamas further expressed condolences to the family of a man who was gunned down by Israeli forces following the operation. The movement also called for more attacks on Israeli troops and settlers. Tel Aviv claims a Palestinian man was shot dead after stabbing an Israeli soldier. In the meantime, scuffles broke out between Israeli troops and Palestinians who were trying to help the wounded man. Regime forces hurled sound grenades and fired tear gas to prevent them from reaching the Palestinian man. The Israeli military has recently stepped up the deadly raids across the occupied territories. Political activist Muti Abu Musabe says Palestinians have no choice but to defend themselves against Israeli atrocities in the wake of the international community's inaction to hold the regime accountable for its crimes.
I think it has become a matter of fact that Israel considers itself as an above the law state. And this is mainly because, and basically because of the impunity given by the international community and by the ongoing and the blind support of the United States administrations that gives the total support for the Israeli occupation without any kind of accountability or without holding the Israeli occupation accountable for committing those crimes and those attacks. Today, the Palestinian people actually is paying the price of that kind of abhorrent silence of the international community. Today, the blood of the Palestinian children and the blood of the Palestinian civilians actually is on the hand of the international community and the United States administrations. And I think today, and without having any kind of sanctions and any kind of holding the Israeli occupation accountable for its crimes, Israel will keep committing its crimes. Therefore, the Palestinian people have no choice but to resist the Israeli occupation with all means available.
A Palestinian inmate held in Israeli jails near the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem has died due to deliberate medical negligence by prison authorities. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned this as a crime and a violation of all humanitarian norms and laws. Mona Kendall tells us more.
Musa Abu Mohammed, 40 years old, a Palestinian man from the town of Beit Amr in Bethlehem, was held by the Israeli forces, and he was arrested several months ago, according to the Israelis, because he was caught in Al-Quds without having Israeli-issued permit. It's prohibited and it's banned for Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank to enter the land occupied in 1948 without Israeli-issued permits. Anyways, this Palestinian man was in a was sick, according to his family, and his health condition deteriorated several weeks ago. But he was transferred to hospital Asaf Harafeh 3 days ago, and unfortunately, this morning he passed away inside the Israeli hospital. Of course, due to medical negligence, he was sick. His health deteriorated, and the Israelis didn't give him the needed medical medications, or even they didn't transfer him to hospital on time. After 3 days in the Israeli hospital, he passed away.
Moscow says the U.S. has so far refrained from issuing visas for the Russian delegation to attend a U.N. General Assembly session later this month. Russia's U.N. ambassador says none of the 56 Russian representatives have received entry visas to the U.S. as of Thursday. That includes Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who is set to lead the delegation to the 77th session of the UNGA. In a letter to the U.N. Secretary General Vasily Nebenzia, called the U.S. move alarming. He said visa issuance is Washington's legal duty and not a right or privilege. According to a 1947 agreement, the U.S. is not allowed to prevent representatives of member states from traveling to the U.N. headquarters in New York. A U.S. State Department spokesman has blamed the delay on forced termination of a local and third country national staff at the U.S. Embassy in Russia. And Russia once again warns the United States against providing Ukraine with long-range weapons, saying Washington is almost becoming a direct party in the conflict.
We are warning the U.S. against taking provocative steps, such as deliveries of longer-range and more devastating weapons. It's a road to nowhere fraught with grave consequences, the responsibility for which will lie entirely on Washington.
The Russian deputy foreign minister also underlined his country's military doctrine that allows it to use nuclear weapons in case of foreign aggression or an existential threat. He said Moscow would push ahead with its offensive in Ukraine until all of its goals were achieved. The U.S. has sent several batches of heavy weapons to Ukraine. Most recently, it provided Kiev with more high-mobility multiple rocket launches, or HIMARS, which have significantly strengthened the capability of the Ukrainian army. The missiles supplied to Kiev have a range of up to 80 kilometers, but the U.S. has expressed its intention to supply those with a range of more than 300 kilometers. Russia has time and again said that the West, the U.S. in particular, are prolonging the war by alarming Ukraine. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency has expressed concern about the physical condition of Ukraine's nuclear power plant due to fighting and shelling in the area.
First is the physical integrity of the facility. What you see here is a red, and it's a big red. Why is it a big red? It's because there's still, we have been seeing military activity around the plant, and I was able to see myself and my team impact holes, markings on buildings of shelling. So it means that the physical integrity of the facility has been violated not once, but several times.
Morsi was speaking in Vienna following a visit to the Russian-controlled plant. To the IAEA mission surveyed the plant and assessed potential damage to it. Morsi, however, dismissed allegations that his visit was restricted or manipulated. That after a Ukrainian president accused Russians of barring international journalists from entering the facility. The Kremlin, for its part, described the IAEA visit as very positive. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for the repeatedly shelling of the plant earlier. The Russian defense minister also accused the U.S. and the EU of encouraging reckless actions around the plant by providing Ukraine with weapons. Kiev has admitted bombing what it calls a Russian base in the district where the plant is located. The G7 group of countries has agreed to impose a price cap on Russian oil imports. Moscow says the move would lead to a shortage in global oil markets and rocketing prices for European consumers. Russia has also warned to retaliate by banning oil exports to countries imposing the restriction. The U.S. and Europe have been pushing for the move for months while facing soaring energy prices and inflation. So will this punitive measure against Russia prove to be effective? And most importantly, won't this destabilize the global economy further?
The G7 countries have agreed to implement a price cap on Russian imports, despite warnings from the Kremlin to hold sales to countries imposing the restriction. Finance ministers of the United States, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, and the United Kingdom agreed on a plan to ban the provisions of services that enable maritime transportation of Russian-origin crude oil and petroleum products globally. This means importers seeking shipping services and insurance cover from companies based in G7 and EU countries would need to adhere to a price cap to transport Russian oil. The level of the cap is still being discussed. The German finance minister has stated the purpose of the move as such.
We want to limit Russia's revenues and at the same time reduce economic damage to our societies. This price cap on Russian oil exports is designed to reduce Putin's revenues.
The cap is expected to take effect at the same time as the next EU embargoes on Russian oil in early December. Moscow has warned that it will retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement the restriction. The Kremlin has warned that a price ceiling will significantly destabilize the oil markets, resulting in scarcity in global oil markets and soaring prices for European consumers. The ban is part of a range of measures taken by the West targeting Russia for the war in Ukraine. In response to the war, the U.S. decided to prohibit the import of oil, refined petroleum products, natural gas, and coal from Russia. These restrictions on Russian energy imports have contributed to higher gas prices and increased inflation pressure across the U.S. Washington's European allies are in no better condition. The European countries have plunged into a devastating energy crisis. Consumers are facing huge bills and the highest rates of inflation since the 1980s. Shell's chief executive officer has earlier warned that gas shortages could persist for several years, raising the prospect of continued energy rationing.
The relationship between the West and Russia is worse than ever. The G7 is trying to stop the export of Russian oil purchased above a certain price. For that to work, the group needs to get non-member states involved. Meanwhile, Moscow has countered the EU and the U.S. sanctions to limit its oil sales by boosting exports to countries like India and China. Moscow has also shut off the EU's Nord Stream gas supply. How far will this war go over energy?
Russian energy giant Gazprom has halted flows via the crucial Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Europe. The company cited an oil leak and didn't give a timeline of when the shipments might resume. This comes in the wake of the G7 countries' decision to impose a price cap on Russian oil. The continued shutdown of the pipeline could exacerbate the energy crisis in Europe, as it is the biggest pipeline for gas from Russia, accounting for about 35% of Europe's total Russian gas imports last year. Russia had already threatened to retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement a price cap. Since June, Gazprom has slashed flows through Nord Stream 1 to just 20% of its capacity, citing maintenance issues as a dispute over a missing turbine caught up in Western export sanctions. It has also cut off supplies to several unfriendly European countries and energy companies over their refusal to pay for gas in rubles. The West has already sanctioned many Russian energy exports, but Moscow has continued to earn billions of dollars a month by diverting oil to countries such as China and India. China's crude imports from Russia soared to a record level in May, ousting Saudi Arabia as the country's top supplier.
The prices that are being paid for Russian oil are far higher than the cost of actually extracting that oil. So what the Russians are taking advantage, in other words, of the situation they're imposing by their boycotts and by the war in Ukraine.
The West is trying to sever the Kremlin's revenues by imposing a ceiling for Russian exports. But Moscow has proved that it can reduce the exporting of its products to Europe and still have mass revenues.
Now, Cuba has accused the United States of pushing its citizens against the government by funding a so-called democracy promotion program in the island nation.
For the United States, it is not enough to have a policy directed at trying to provoke hunger, malnutrition, and scarcity in Cuba. Besides that, after doing this, they are urging the Cuban people by using $6 million from taxpayers to rise up against the government because of the problems we are facing as a result of the blockade.
The deputy foreign minister called those programs interventionist and illegal. Fernandez said that Washington has been trying to topple the Cuban government for decades but has never attempted in such an explicit way. He said that the U.S. punishes its own citizens for working as foreign agents but encourages such illegal behavior in other countries. In July, the U.S. President Joe Biden announced a program which awards organizations and individuals over $6 million for, quote, promoting democratic change in Cuba. The Caribbean island nation has been under a U.S. embargo since 1962. It is now grappling with its worst economic crisis, with acute shortages of fuel and basic goods such as food and medicine. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on July 27, 2022.
The second point is to deal with everyone as though you are their father. All sorts of people attend your Friday prayers. Be kind to everyone. They are all your children. I understand that you might be more interested in the young revolutionary fighters. I don't blame you, and that's fine. But even if someone is not like that, there are still your sons. There are still your children. Even in his own home, a person might love one of his children more than the others, but this should not prevent him from being a father to his other children. You need to treat everyone as though you are their father and they are all your children. The Ghadir celebration in Tehran, in which over 3 million people attended in the form of a 10-kilometer long celebration, was truly extraordinary. I don't know whether you saw it or not. I saw it on television myself and heard about it from some people who had attended. Did you see how all sorts of people took part in this celebration in the millions? These people are in favor of religion. They like religion. One time during one of my trips to one of the provinces, I had a meeting with the respected scholars of that province. I told them, as I was coming today or yesterday, there was a crowd surrounding the car I was in. They wanted to express their love, and some of them were even crying. Amongst them, there were individuals whom, if you had met them, you wouldn't have thought they even believed in religion. But that's the way it is. They do believe in religion. I have a lot to say on this topic, and I have talked about this in the past. Now isn't the time to talk more about it. So treat everyone in a fatherly manner and bring everyone to sit at the table of religion and spirituality. This is another point.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another matter is that the behavior of the Friday prayer leader should be people-oriented. He needs to be a people person. What do we mean by being a people person? It means that as one of the people, you need to go and be present amongst them, talk to them, and don't distance yourself from them. Don't just interact with the special privileged group. If necessary, go to people's homes every now and then, sit on their rugs and under the roofs of their houses, ask them how they are. Just being amongst the people is an important task in itself. Some people making inappropriate interpretations about the very valuable public visits of officials is wrong. In fact, these people have been misled. Going amongst the people, talking and listening to them is important.
I wanna thank you for all the things that you've
Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
African nations and Africans in the diaspora are reviving their efforts to obtain reparations from colonial powers involved in the evil transatlantic slave trade and other colonial era atrocities. In pursuit of this objective, early August, a reparations and racial healing summit was held in Ghana. Addressing the summit, Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo pushed for reparations, but reiterated that no amount of money could restore the damage done by the slave trade.
You cannot quantify the effects of such tragedies, but they need to be recognized. Africa and her peoples lost out tremendously in that period, and its ripple effects are still being felt right till this very day.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today's edition is focusing on the recent summit on reparations and racial healing held in Accra, Ghana. The meeting discussed and reflected on the legacies of the transatlantic slave trade, slavery in America, colonialism, and strategies for reparations and racial healing. The second segment of our show today is on the latest developments regarding Britain's controversial plan to forcibly send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Our guests will be giving us their expert analysis on today's subjects, and you can also be part of the conversation by sending us your comments through our social media handle.
Africa demands reparations for slavery. A global summit on reparations and racial healing was held in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, early August. The summit was co-hosted by the African Union Commission and the Africa Transitional Justice Legacy Fund. The main agenda of the meeting was to coordinate a comprehensive global strategy and agenda to secure reparations for the immoral and brutal transatlantic slave trade and European colonialism in Africa.
Speaking to Ghana's Joy TV, one of the participants elaborates on some of the salient points of the Accra Summit.
One, the importance of prioritizing reparations, not just as a process of remembering, but as the path forward to the kind of self-determining agency that we want for Africa and for people of African descent around the world. We have a collective strategy that is now in development that engages not just the grassroots, but also we have the African Union Commission has been involved on this question of how to develop a common position for Africa on the issue of reparations and healing. So a lot of this was about building relationships between inside the continent, but also between Africa and the diaspora, so that we can know each other, understand each other, develop collective strategy to challenge and change the systems and structures that, from the transatlantic slave trade through colonialism, neocolonialism, continue to exploit and harm.
Well, for more on the Accra Reparations Summit, we contacted Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me.
At the end of the Reparations Summit, a declaration known as the Accra Declaration was issued to push forward a global agenda for reparations and healing. Now, what is the importance of such a conference that took place in Accra?
Oh, it's extremely important. As you and your audience probably know, for a long time here in the United States, the descendants of enslaved Africans have been crusading, have been campaigning with regard to gaining reparations for the horrific depredations that were inflicted upon not only people of African descent in North America, but on the African continent as a whole. Indeed, Africa's underdevelopment today can be connected quite directly to the ravages of the African slave trade, which operated for centuries from about 1500 till about the late 19th century. And this meant that North America, the United States in particular, was built into its present superpower status by the free labor of enslaved Africans.
Speaking at the Reparations and Racial Healing Summit, Ghana's president said these reparations were long overdue and needed to be intensified. He questioned double standards in the reparations debate when it came to other races and ethnic groups that were wronged historically. Let's take a listen.
We believe the calls for reparations to Africa are just. The effects of the slave trade have been devastating to the continent and to the African diaspora. The entire period of slavery meant that our progress, economically, culturally, and psychologically, was stifled.
Now, I'd like to ask Mr. Horn, what's his take on the statement by the president of Ghana?
Well, he is absolutely correct. Recall that after what is referred to as the Holocaust, the killing of 6 million Jewish people in Central and Eastern Europe in the 1930s and the 1940s, you had the successor state in Berlin to Hitler's Germany pay reparations to Israel, even though Israel was not in existence at the time of the Holocaust. You still have reparations being paid to various peoples of Jewish descent, not only in Europe and in Israel, but in North America too. In the United States, you may recall that during World War II, 1941 to 1945, the United States in turn put in concentration camps Japanese Americans. About four decades later, the United States government apologized and paid reparations to those who had endured that horrible fate. And so I think the Ghanaian authorities were referring to these episodes when they made reference to hypocrisy and double standards, because it's apparent that hypocrisy and double standards persist.
The wealth of Western countries is built on slavery and colonialism, yet reparations have been routinely dismissed by Western leaders. For instance, the then British Prime Minister David Cameron, on a visit to Jamaica in 2015, rejected popular demands for compensation over slavery and colonialism. As expected, Cameron arrogantly stated that it was best for Jamaicans to move on.
No, I haven't been taken aback. Of course, this is an important debate. I mean, my view is that as we look into the past, we should think of all of the aspects of the past, not least the action that Britain took for many decades to wipe slavery off the high seas and off the face of our planet. And so I don't think reparations are the right answer. But the purpose of my visit is to look to the future.
There are concerns that the movement for reparations and apology will face major obstacles due to such stances by British officials.
Well, I think the London authorities need to rethink that inappropriate comment. One cannot understand or comprehend the British Empire, which once ruled a good deal of the world, including what is today's India, today's Pakistan, a good deal of Afghanistan and other neighbors of Iran. The British Empire was basically built upon labor of enslaved Africans. And so when the British authorities talk about it's time to move on, well, I think that that's not only insulting, it's obscene. They should be forced to apologize.
The president of Ghana also noted that even before these discussions on reparations conclude, the entire continent of Africa deserves a formal apology from the European nations involved in the slave trade for the crimes and damage it has caused to Africans. He lamented that Western countries are still practicing racism when it comes to reparations.
Predictably, the question of reparations becomes a debate only when it comes to Africa and Africans. When the British ended slavery, all the owners of enslaved slaves, Africans, received reparations to the tune of £20 million, the equivalent today of £20 billion. But enslaved Africans themselves did not receive a penny. Likewise, in the United States, owners of slaves received $300 for every slave they owned. The slaves themselves received nothing.
As Mr. Horn stated earlier, colonial powers involved in slavery must be forced to apologize. So why have these European powers so far refused to apologize and pay reparations for the crimes they committed?
Because they are enmeshed in a system that is not only immoral, but racist. And keep in mind, when we talk about the European nations that were involved in the slave trade, we're not only talking about Britain and France and Spain and Portugal. We're also talking about Denmark, for example. You may know that the U.S. territory known as the Virgin Islands was first controlled by Denmark before it was turned over about 100 years ago to the U.S. authorities. And of course, the Virgin Islands has an overwhelmingly black population because of the slave trade. The Swedes were involved in the slave trade. So this is a crime against humanity perpetrated by leading nations of Western Europe who purport to be paragons of human rights virtue, but actually are no more than pirates and thieves and immoral knaves.
The Church, and especially the Roman Catholic Church as an institution, was instrumental in facilitating the transatlantic slave trade.
The church played a direct role and was complicit in the sins of anti-black racism, slavery, and segregation in the modern era. An African-American historian gives a glimpse of how the church was involved in enslaving Africans.
Catholics had used slaves and the slave economy to evade anti-Catholic laws and survive anti-Catholic violence. They embraced human bondage to secure their own liberty. The pro-slavery and anti-abolitionist tradition in the Catholic hierarchy began not with the arrival of the Irish in the 19th century, but with the emergence of the Catholic Church as a legal institutional church at the end of the American Revolution.
Now, what role should the church play in pushing for reparations?
The Vatican should be in the forefront of the campaign for reparations, not only because the Roman Catholic Church was deeply implicated in the African slave trade. Indeed, you may be familiar with Georgetown University, a university that sits in Washington, D.C., and was initiated by the Roman Catholic Church. You may also know that about 200 years ago, when Georgetown University fell upon hard times, it sold scores of enslaved Africans in order to fatten its bottom line. And that's one of the reasons why you've had delegations of Black Americans traveling to the Vatican, engaging in discussions and consultations with the Vatican authorities about their role in the African slave trade, because the Vatican is supposedly a moral authority. That's one of the reasons why you had the Pope recently visit Canada, apologizing for what the Catholics did to the indigenous population of Canada.
These are a very emotional topic indeed for Africans, and we look forward to the day when the perpetrators of slavery apologize for their crimes and pay reparations. Here at Press TV, we shall keep you posted as Africans in Africa and the diaspora pursue reparations and healing. I would like to thank Gerald Horn, a professor of history at the University of Houston, for his insight. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the controversial plan by Britain to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Stay tuned.
Britain ignores warnings over Rwanda asylum plan. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Reports have revealed that the British government was warned not to send asylum seekers to Rwanda as the government in this Central African country tortures and kills political opponents. The warning came several weeks before the British government attempted to forcibly send asylum seekers to Rwanda.
The controversial plan was temporarily halted after the European Court of Human Rights issued injunctions to force the cancellation of the first deportation flight hours before it was due to leave for Rwanda in June. London's High Court is also expected to hear the case in early September, when a coalition of human rights groups and a trade union will argue that the Rwanda policy is unworkable and unethical.
Britain's plan has attracted international condemnation. The spokesperson for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees says it is a violation of international law to send asylum seekers to Rwanda against their will.
Asylum seekers, people seeking asylum and safety. And we just want to reiterate that access to asylum should not be and is not contingent on the mode of arrival, how people arrive.
Now, for more on Britain's plan to forcibly send refugees to Rwanda, we contacted Claude Gachebuke, the co-author of the book Survivors Uncensored. He's also a survivor of the Rwanda genocide and currently the executive director of the Africa Great Lakes Action Network. Thanks a lot for your time today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the British government was reportedly warned several times by its own advisors that it's not prudent to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. So why did London ignore this advice?
I think London ignored the voice and the advice because at the end of the day, their attitude was they do not care about the well-being of the asylum seekers and the refugees who were seeking refuge in Britain. They were only looking to score political points. And at the time, there was such turmoil in the British government that it was just a nice cover-up to use the refugee issue and the immigrant issue, which is usually the default, to kind of hide behind and distract from the political issues.
Britain claims to champion for human rights, yet it has ignored human rights experts who have objected to plans to transfer asylum seekers to Rwanda. There is concern that many of the asylum seekers will endure suffering in Rwanda. A protester speaks here during a march against the controversial plan in London.
They are not looking at what exactly is in that country. They are looking at the fact that Britain is getting an opportunity to dispose of asylum seekers. But they are not seeing the life they are putting in danger.
What does it say of the double standards pursued by Britain and other Western countries when it comes to human rights?
I was actually one of the most vocal voices when it comes to this issue of transferring immigrants to Rwanda. I called it human trafficking. I called it slavery. I called it basically bundling people up and shipping them from Britain to Rwanda. What it says about Britain and West's attitude toward human rights is that the only human rights they care about are the human rights of people, Western people. It's well known that Rwanda has a horrible record on human rights, yet it still receives hundreds of thousands of dollars from the British, from the Americans, and from the European Union. And if these refugees were coming from countries that are Western countries, where most of the refugees were white, I believe, very strongly believe, that they would not be shipped to Rwanda.
The UK-Rwanda asylum plan has come under fire as rising numbers of refugees are crossing the channel in small boats to seek refuge in the UK. In July, 3,683 people crossed from France. The total number of this year is believed to be more than 17,000. Britain claims its policy of forcibly sending asylum seekers to Rwanda will help end the people smugglers' trade. But now many analysts disagree with this claim.
I absolutely disagree, because actually what Britain is doing by basically trading these humans with Rwanda, it's human trafficking in itself. The only difference is that this time it's legalized. It's government to government that are trafficking humans. You cannot take a person from a place that they desire to be and take them to a place that they do not desire to be.
Despite Iran's economic difficulties and unjust sanctions, the country generously hosts millions of asylum seekers from various countries, particularly Afghanistan. When he was the UNCHR chief, Antonio Guterres, the current UN Secretary General, visited Iran in 2014. During the visit, he paid glowing tribute to the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Iranian people for continuing to preserve asylum space for the refugees.
It is only fair to pay tribute to the generosity
of the people and the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran that for decades have received, have protected, and have assisted at the moment almost 3 million refugees, still today almost 1 million refugees, sharing everything with them and providing them the access to shelter, to work, to education for their children, to health services, and allowing them to have a dignifying life while waiting for the possibility to go back home.
While Iran is hosting millions of refugees and granting them full rights, on the other hand, the self-proclaimed flag bearers of human rights, such as Britain, cannot tolerate the presence of thousands of refugees. What's your take on this?
That is such an irony that you point out. It just goes to show that when it comes to human rights, Western hypocrisy comes out flying. And for example, if you would look at the criticism that Iran gets and the praise that Rwanda gets and compare the human rights abuses in both places, it's crazy to see that such a champion of human rights would actually criticize one and go after the other. Now, with Britain not being able to tolerate even thousands of people who are in distress, that just goes to show that many times their claim to human rights is just completely lip service.
The Rwanda scheme presents a sad reminder of Britain's imperial past, the colonial transportation of slaves and workers across continents and seas. Imposing the asylum plan in a poor country such as Rwanda is financially beneficial to the UK and is seen as part of Britain's post-Brexit strategy. So, can we say that the Rwanda asylum plan is a clear reflection of Britain's imperial past?
Absolutely. I've been saying this since the very first day this deal was announced. I'd say that this is not only human trafficking, this is no different than the transatlantic slave trade, where humans were being traded for money. And so this legalized human trafficking between the UK and Rwanda basically takes humans against their will, takes them to a place they do not desire to be, and there is an exchange of money. There is a price for actually doing that service. So people are being treated like commodities. They're being treated like goods. And that's basically what was happening even with the transatlantic slave trade. And so today, this is just a complete reflection of Britain's colonial past, slave trading past, but also neo-colonialist attitude and imperialist attitude.
Well, there you have it. Britain's controversial plan to forcibly transfer asylum seekers to Rwanda is a continuation of its evil legacy of slave trade and imperialism. Thank you very much, Mr. Claude Bitabuke, for your incisive analysis today. And that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed guest speaker, Sheikh Noor Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you to the studio and, of course, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Our question today might be quite a general one. It's definitely going to be an interesting question to answer at the very least, because it deals with the entire concept of God. Why do we have this concept of God, are we asked? And if we believe that there is a God and we have proven that there is a God, why must God be one thing or one single thing and not multiple gods? So, dear Sheikh, I don't know where you're going to want to start out with this. But maybe we can start with figuring out the whole concept of God.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Very valid question. Many people ask about the existence of God, about the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and whether he exists or not.
Yep.
Yeah, you know that in the beginning, I would like to ask my dear listeners and I would like to invite them for further and in-depth study about God and about the existence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, this is a very kind and friendly invitation to all my dear listeners, you know, to have in-depth study about some of the theological issues, including Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because we are talking about the divine existence. You know, if you go to the Islamic text, you find a lot of explanation about oneness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which we call it Tawheed. Okay, and it is one of the Islamic principles, and it is necessary, and actually it is obligation, kind of obligation upon all Muslims to have, you know, these arguments, and, you know, via istidlal, which we call it rational argument, to understand and to recognize Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and to go to this study and to, let's say, you know, have a, you know, let's say, rational understanding about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, about oneness of Allah and about other attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Right. It is very important. And if you look at all Risala Amaliyya, which is, you know, practical laws of Islam, you find all the scholars, they have mentioned in the beginning of their practical law that it is obligation, you know, upon all Muslims to have these rational arguments for understanding right. All theological issues. So we are talking about the one of the most fundamental issues, and unfortunately, maybe some people, they do not have enough time to have some further study. If they have some minutes, maybe, or some hours, you know, of a study about the theological issue, they can easily come to this understanding about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Let's go to the question about oneness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and about the concept of God. You know that if you want to understand whether, you know, according to Islam, this divine religion of Allah, whether Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala exists or not, or you may call it Lord or God or any other, you know, expression that you may like, I would like to say that you should start it from your own existence, okay? If you look at your own existence, you find that human being in the beginning of the creation is a drop of fluid, okay?
Right.
And this, you know, this sperm gradually has a, growth, and after that become the a complete human being.
It develops, right. It has a cycle of development. Right.
Exactly. So please look at this growth of human being from the drop of fluid and gradually become the complete human being. My question is to this dear questioner, please look at this process carefully and understand whether, I want to say that who has created and who has given this ability and capacity to this drop of fluid to become the complete human being.
So, dear Sheikh, you would say to understand why there is a concept of God, we should look at some rational arguments for the existence of God, right?
Yes.
But what do we say to those who, instead of calling this existence God, they call it evolution or Mother Nature, or now they've taken to calling it the universe. The universe wants this, the universe does that. How can we tell them that this isn't, or how do we prove that this isn't just the universe, but it is in fact a creator who is actively doing these things, who we call Allah?
You know, the example that I gave you, I want to say that, look at this example. Can we say that the process of the creation of human being from the beginning till the end, it has been given to him or her by universe? Or, for example, any other thing rather than the creator who is almighty, all-powerful, all-knowing? I want to say that rationally speaking, okay, is it possible to give all these capacities and abilities to the human being and this very, I can say, huge system of the creation of human being and this huge process
right. Via,
I don't know, by, for example, by universe or any right. Other thing, or for example, randomly it has been created.
Right.
Is that possible, rationally speaking? The problem is, my dear host, that unfortunately some people, they do not reflect on many issues which are considered to be miracle. But
exactly,
because
yeah.
we have been used to that, because on a daily basis when we see different things which are actually, you know, some kind of miracle, but because we have been used to that, we do not care about that and we do not reflect about that.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Actually, the Quran talks about this quite explicitly. It says that it addresses the human being. He says, why do you not think? Why do not لا يتفكرون, think in creation, reflect upon the creation? Because
exactly.
In that, there are signs of Allah. So again, we are actually saying that this concept, it is founded on a irrational foundation, actually, that this concept is not just something we have imagined. It is actually rational. And it is well argumented, is what we're trying to say here. Right, Sheikh?
Exactly. I want to say that, you know, rationally speaking, without looking at any religion or any faith, I want to say that if you go to your wisdom, you understand that the creation of human being, of course, I will give you more example. And of course, we have plenty of examples of the creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.